This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Since You Asked is a specialty show that includes articles and columns on advice, commentary, and opinion. This program is funded by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. Views expressed in this program are those of the authors or publications, and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or its volunteer readers. My name is Alita, and I am your volunteer reader. Our first article today is from the New York Times of April 18th, 2026, Ask the Ethicist, by Kwame Anthony Appiah. My husband's illness has me feeling trapped. Do I have to stay? My husband and I have been married for decades. Almost 10 years ago, he was diagnosed with a progressive disease that affects his mobility. Though it started slowly in the past few years, he has had a steep decline. He is now mostly housebound. Although he can drive, getting around once he arrives somewhere is a challenge. He uses a walker and a scooter, and he cannot raise his arms well. He falls often, and we recently called 911 for help after he fell and I couldn't get him up. He gets no exercise and has gained a lot of weight. We sleep in separate rooms because of his snoring and his needs. I am effectively his caregiver. I am also the housekeeper, laundress, cook, grocery shopper, and more. At one time, these were tasks we shared. Now it's all on my shoulders. Mentally, he is still functioning, but it has been sad, stressful, and difficult for me to watch his decline. It's also lonely. I feel I no longer have a partner to enjoy activities with. My husband and I traveled extensively during our marriage, and I'm grateful for that, as it is no longer possible for us to travel together. Right now, I feel like a shut-in with my husband. We don't go anywhere or do anything because it's too difficult. Some friends remain, but others have drifted away because his disability makes people uncomfortable. I am in good health and have been active all my life. If I left my husband, I would have a more peaceful, less stressful life with more independence and less responsibility. It seems like living single again would be an immense relief, and I would probably be happier. I would like to do it, but I don't feel morally that I could. To walk out on him now seems selfish. But I have healthy years ahead. It's my life, and I wish to enjoy what's left. My quandary is, do I stay or do I go? From the Ethicist. Even nowadays, when so many couples choose to write their own wedding vows, those vows typically include some version of the promise to love and to cherish in sickness and in health. There has always been something slightly odd, though, about vowing not only to act in certain ways, but also to feel in certain ways. Love isn't a performance. And while cherishing can be expressed through action, it also involves seeing and feeling that another person is precious. We can try to preserve those feelings, but we can't guarantee that they will endure. And the emulation of loving behavior motivated by duty alone isn't what we hope for in a spouse, or, for that matter, a friend. I say all this because you don't describe your husband as someone you still love, even as you grieve his limitations. In your account, he emerges as a list of chores, an unliftable burden, as someone whose needs have come at the expense of your own. For many spouses in circumstances like yours, the experience is different. Sorrow and devotion are both present. The caregiving can be lonely and draining, but it can also be a source of meaning. Without that sustaining love, by contrast, the responsibilities of care can result in sheer depletion. Still, I am not convinced that your only choices are to stay or to go. Life is usually too complicated for such either-ors. What's obvious is that too much has fallen on you, and you are buckling under the strain. But the first question to ask isn't whether to stay the course or plot your escape. The first question is to ask whether you can carve out a more livable existence within the marriage you have. This would probably begin with practical changes. You'll want to explore every available form of additional care and support. You'll want to figure out how to spare yourself some of the labor you describe so that you have time outside the house, time with friends, time for the activities that restore you, perhaps time for the occasional trip on your own. You don't mention financial hardship. If you have the resources, arrange dependable care that could improve not only your life, but your husband's as well. He may, in fact, be better served by responsible helpers than by a wife who is dejected and nearing her limit. In your current state, you'd be wise not to make any irrevocable decisions. If cherishing can't simply be summoned by force of will, then honesty and mercy can still guide you. Consider speaking candidly with your husband, perhaps with the help of a couples counselor, about what this arrangement has become for you and what each of you now needs. What you are facing is an especially painful version of something that many long marriages eventually encounter. When one partner becomes far more frail than the other, the life they have shared must be reimagined. The pressing task for you is to see whether that life can be reshaped enough that you aren't lost inside it. Next, from the April 19th, 2026 Boston Globe, Love Letters by Meredith Goldstein. Question. I am currently in a relationship with this charming and handsome guy. We have been together for 6 months now. Our relationship is smooth so far, not much call for compromise. The issue is my mother. She's a single mom, divorced, and she worries that I might meet the wrong man and wind up on the same path as her. She doesn't like most of my boyfriends and is very picky. I live with her and am very close with my family. I spend a lot of time with my boyfriend and want to see him as much as possible. My thought was that I should have him around the house as often as I can so that my mom and my relatives get used to him. But that seems to have backfired. Now my mom and relatives feel like I see him too much and that it's inappropriate for me to be so affectionate with him in the house. I'm not planning to move out. That's not how it works in my family. But I'd like to know what people think I should do. How should I manage my family and my relationship? From Meredith. First, it's only been 6 months. Yes, that feels like a long time and things are going well, but you're still getting to know your boyfriend, as is your family. Give everybody some time to get used to him and to see that he plans to stick around. Also, start thinking of your family members as roommates, because some of them are. If you lived with friends, you wouldn't have your boyfriend over all of the time, right? You'd respect your roommate's need for space and privacy. You'd consider how a guest changes the dynamic. Living at home is no different. Guests are great, but bringing a boyfriend to the house day after day probably won't endear him to your family. As you try to find a better balance, you can talk to your mom and your family about how you can get serious with someone and still live at home. Let them know you're having trouble with the balance. Maybe they'll listen and have some ideas. No matter what, know that it might be uncomfortable for a bit. This is a big life change for you, and everybody else is catching up. Be assertive, but remember that even with friends, it can take a while for people to understand and accept that you're part of a couple. From the readers. Ultimately, as long as you live under their roof, you're going to be faced with having to blend in with their wants, needs, opinions into your life. You're basically inflicting another roommate on your family. Try going to his place sometimes. Go out more often. Your boyfriend should pick you up at the house. Be gracious and polite. Then you should go somewhere else together. Talk to your family members respectfully and as a competent adult, not as a child needing guidance. You might also need to desensitize yourself to their criticisms and explain to them without anger or angst that you respect their opinions, but this relationship is something you need to explore. Slow down with your boyfriends. They do not need to be hanging around the house, especially at only 6 months. Spend your time actually going on dates. Trying to inflict your significant other on others is kind of selfish, and it has only been 6 months, not 6 years. Next, from the April 21st, 2026 edition of the Washington Post, Carolyn Hacks. Partner's needy texts intrude on rare one-on-one time with kid. Dear Carolyn, I'm a divorced parent of a young adult who lives in another city. Child and I just went on a short vacation together, time that I treasure because it's perhaps the one time all year when we can give each other nearly undivided attention. During our vacation, my significant other was down and feeling lonely because not only was I on vacation, but their children also happened to be away with their other parent. S.O. texted me multiple times to describe how sad and miserable they were and made a fuss when they thought I was not texting or calling back promptly enough to respond to their sadness. I've since explained that my focus was on my child, and that we were often occupied when the texts came in, and that S.O. needed to be more patient, which I think they understand now. But when I examine this deep down, I resent my S.O. for even sending me texts complaining about their sadness and loneliness. This was not an emergency or a self-harm risk situation. I get feeling left out when others are away having fun. It stinks. But just seeing the "I'm so miserable" text pop up on my screen brought me down and took away from being fully present with my child and enjoying my time off. Should I be more empathetic? Signed, Anonymous. Anonymous. Empathy's great, sure. But it doesn't make what your partner did any less of a red flag. Understanding it doesn't excuse it. If more empathy gives you a better grasp of the impact on your child's feelings, then put me down for a yes. Because the needy texts didn't just cut into your vacation enjoyment. Your kid was shortchanged. You sort of say this, but it needs saying outright. Especially since any young adult with divorced parents, I don't think this is too bold an assumption here, will have a micro-sensitivity to being asked to cut their attention budget short in order to cover a parent's intimate relationship costs. When you put a label like empathy on it, then you risk passing off mushy priorities as a virtue. You're asking valid, important questions about your partner's behavior. Don't lose your nerve. Have the courage to follow through. Empathy makes us better, but if your approach begins and ends with validating everyone, then you've got the same recipe for the same frustration you felt on the ruined vacation. All feelings, no hierarchy, no gatekeeper. Your deep-down gut resentment knows the truth. People are entitled to their feelings, yes, but you get the last word on your life. Your priority was your vacation with your child, and that call was yours to make, period. It was a healthy call, too, for you and, crucially, for your kid. But that's actually beside the current point, which is healthy adults respect the authority of self. They don't push to displace it with their own. Look what happened here. Once you set your priority, kid, your partner didn't respectfully step back, but instead undermined you repeatedly, texting, to satisfy their craving, attention. Maybe also beside the point, but really, couldn't amuse self for a few days? The persistent encroachment to demand that you meet their emotional needs for them would not have been okay on a solo trip either, by the way. Empathy is totally appropriate here for gaining insight into why a partner might do this, or why you might be susceptible to someone who uses these tactics. It can keep a breakup over it civil and compassionate. Empathy is decidedly worth holding out for in a significant other, too. Where was theirs for you and your kid during the trip? Don't limit your follow-through to questions about your SO, either. Treat this as a proto-epiphany about boundaries. Read up on them. Talk some with a therapist. Al-Anon is good on the topic in general and free. Reflect on past relationships. Did past partners cut into your plans? Did you let them? This could be the beginning of a beautiful spine. Now, Asking Eric, from the April 16th, 2026 Washington Post, by R. Eric Thomas. Rough nursing appointment scares patient. Can letter writer ask for a different nurse after a bad appointment? Dear Eric, I have blood drawn weekly. The last time the needle prick stung a good bit, unlike all the others, and the next day my arm was black and blue. Next time when I go in and my number is drawn, if I see that nurse, would it be acceptable to decline and say I'll wait for the next nurse? Signed, Bad Blood Draw. Draw. That's acceptable. It's your body, and you should feel comfortable with how it's treated. You might get better results, however, by calling ahead. You might get better results, however, by calling ahead or raising your concern about the last draw you had before taking a number. It's possible it was a one-time fluke, or that the nursing staff can make adjustments to ensure it doesn't happen again. Dear Eric, I am passionate about my political beliefs and display posters and other things showing it. Most people in my area believe the opposite. I'm wary of offending anyone who comes into my home in advance. I'd like to avoid it if I can. Is this what I should be doing? I know how touchy a subject it is these days. Signed, Agree to Disagree. Agree. At the risk of making the question too simple, are your signs saying offensive or abusive things? You write that your passion for your beliefs is what motivates you to display the signs in the first place. So I can't help but wonder if you think the signs might offend a passerby as well as a visitor to your home. If the answer is yes, you might ask yourself what the distinction is between a passerby and a visitor in your mind, and what you're trying to accomplish with your signage. Ultimately, your passions are part of who you are. You demonstrate that by hanging the signs in the window. If you stand behind what you believe and think having a public conversation about it is important, then visitors have the choice to either engage or stay away. Dear Eric, in a recent column, Concerned Daughter wrote that her 87-year-old mother has pancreatic cancer and has been experiencing severe brain fog, fatigue, and memory issues. Yet, she continues to drive. A similar situation arose with my mother. I told her doctor that she was still driving. He ordered a driving assessment through a rehabilitation center. She did poorly on the driving test, so they notified her insurance company and they canceled her insurance. I spirited away her keys. I believe that my mother's anger and her depression at losing her independence was insignificant compared to another human being being injured or killed. I believe that it was my moral and ethical responsibility to do so. I could never have forgiven myself for not trying if I hadn't done all I could to prevent such an occurrence and the worst happened. Signed, my ethical responsibility. Responsibility. Thank you for your response and the suggestion. Many state DMVs make it possible for people to anonymously report drivers who are impaired or may be a danger to themselves and others. That's another option for the letter writer. In my original response, I neglected to fully address the danger that the mother is likely posing by insisting on driving. While other aspects of the letter suggest that creating a boundary in the relationship will help everyone involved, it's imperative that the letter writer or someone close to her intervenes with her mother's driving right away. Dear Eric, I love your column. I read with interest the column regarding the person in the exercise class that counted loudly and was distracting to the writer. As a fitness instructor for more than 22 years, I always encourage my students to count aloud as it helps with breathing during the class. You'd be surprised how many students hold their breath while exercising. I even did contests to see which side of the room was louder. The participants were all energized and had fun in the classes. That being said, I can understand if the class was more low-key and one person was being distracting to the others, they should be brought to the attention of the instructor. The instructor should be willing to make the class enjoyable for all participants. Signed, Counting on It. Counting. As someone who used to frequently forget to breathe in workout class, I appreciate your technique. And you make a good point. The counting may be beneficial to the counter or to the run of the class. The letter writer's best course of action is to talk to the instructor about the class environment. The writer may find that the instructor is also aware of the counting and doesn't see it as an impediment to productive group workouts. And from the April 20th, 2026 Washington Post, Miss Manners. I'm invited to a party celebrating a lot of people I don't know. Dear Miss Manners, I received a save the date email from a friend's sister. She described how the family was going to celebrate all the milestones occurring this year, including my friend and his wife's 50th wedding anniversary, and the milestone birthdays of 13 other family members. They have rented a very prestigious venue that will easily hold several hundred people. It has been billed as a no-gifts event. Of all the people being celebrated, the only ones I know are my friend and his wife. Quite honestly, I would feel a bit odd attending an event where I only know one couple out of more than a dozen being celebrated. I don't know if there will be a charge for this event, but given the expected expense, it is not easy to imagine someone else picking up the check for all of us. I don't think I'd feel comfortable paying for tickets to celebrate someone else's family. I'd like to know if this is a new thing, or if indeed this is something unusual. I'm struggling to come up with a good excuse for not attending, as I can't imagine feeling comfortable at such an event. But sometimes there are social repercussions to not attending. Gentle reader, What kind of people do you suspect your relatives are? Ones who would charge you admission to their family celebrations and punish you if you declined? Mind you, Miss Manners is no longer surprised at the crassness and greed in what are supposed to be social transactions, or the assumption that such is a friend's motivation for entertaining. What does surprise her is that targeted victims would even consider complying. But what makes you think such is the case here? You do not mention having been asked for money. You have been specifically told not to bring presents. What justification do you have to think this invitation is a lure to fleece you? Isn't it possible these are just nice people and your friends only want to include you in the festivities as they gather to celebrate this anniversary? Anyway, you have no obligation to attend, nor need to give an excuse when the actual invitation arrives. Just send your congratulations along with your regret at missing the party. And that's it for today. You have been listening to articles and advice columns from Since You Asked. This show is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. This is Alita. I'll be with you again next week. Thank you for listening.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
This is Bird Note. Birds make all kinds of sounds, from squawks to chirps to warbles, and they can have different meanings. When you're first starting to bird by ear, it can be helpful to learn the difference between songs and calls. Birds produce songs to establish territory, attract a mate, and fend off rivals. They're more frequently performed by males during the breeding season, but many species sing year-round, and some female birds sing too. For example, male and female northern cardinals produce a song with clear whistles. Songs can also be dry and mechanical, like this chipping sparrow's, or jumbled and metallic, like this great-tailed grackle's. For everything else they need to say, birds use calls. Contact calls help birds stick together while foraging or traveling. This American goldfinch makes a flight call to let the flock know he's still with the group. When there's danger nearby, black-capped chickadees make a distinctive alarm call. In fact, chickadee alarm calls are understood by dozens of other species, including birds and birders. For Bird Note, I'm Joni Franklin. Support comes from Wild Delight Bird Food, offering a variety of blends designed to mimic the natural resources wild birds crave. Available at Chewy.com.
Hello, listeners. On Tuesday, May 5th at 6 p.m., Speaking Volumes begins a brand new book titled Fried Green Tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe by Fanny Flagg. Be sure to get your copy now for this stimulating conversation.
WICN Public Radio is a proud partner of Audio Journal. Audio Journal provides news, information, and entertainment to visually and print-impaired residents of central Massachusetts. Audio Journal broadcasts are made possible through the use of a portion of WICN's broadcast frequency. 90.5 WICN is Worcester's only NPR affiliate and the voice of arts and culture in central Massachusetts. Visit WICN.org for more info.
Listen to Audio Journal on your smart speaker. Just say, Alexa, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn. Or, hey Google, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn.